I want to tell you about a new sponsor here on the program. It's our first sponsor in a while, but in this time of economic uncertainty, this is a great, great business for all of you to partner with. It's Dashing Media Management. New ways of talking to customers are being created left and right, and you need an expert to help guide you through that process. That's where my friend Lex Kramer and Dashing Media Management come in. They're able to help you with social media, blog management, content marketing, graphics, and pretty much all of your marketing needs. They're a one-stop shop. They feature flat rate pricing, transparent reporting, and Lex is just a great person to work with, a good friend of mine, and I hope that you'll support her. So I hope you'll reach out to Lex today at their website, dashingmediamanagement.com. You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Find more great shows like this at wearelibertarians.com. Hey everyone, it's Chris Spangles. So nice to speak with you again, and this is another round of conversations with nonprofits, and while these are based in Indianapolis, the needs are pretty much the same in every city across the nation as you look around. I don't know if you saw the enormous line of cars in Houston, miles long, trying to get to a food bank. You can check that out on the Wall Instagram page, but food security just comes up over and over and over again in these conversations. And the reason I want to bring it to you is because these people are on the ground, and so sometimes it's hard to get a good idea when you read the press of what's actually happening out in society or what's happening in places that aren't on your own personal timeline. Because we tend to flock together, say, you know, what is that saying? Birds of the same feather flock together. So your social media isn't always representative of what's happening around the country or even in your own community or next door, because you tend to find people that look like you, talk like you, think like you, same tax bracket, that sort of thing. And so I want to bring these to you because I think it's important to hear what's happening on the ground in nonprofits first, so you can get a good education of what people are experiencing, especially those who are unemployed right now. And secondly, so you can get involved. I think it's just super important, as I always say on the show, for libertarians. We often, and I'm guilty of this, we often have the idea that the government is tyrannical and society is just super government focused. We're hyper focused on the government, and we often fail to realize that our governments are reactive. They follow the lead of its people. And there was a survey, as we talked about on the show in the last couple episodes here in Indiana, that out of 1,000 people, 80% of those people, 800 people, felt that the governor's actions for sheltering in place were correct. So there's a huge challenge in persuading people. And what's the best way to persuade people that your ideology is right? Well, lead. And right now, I think libertarians have a huge opportunity to lead in helping people get through this struggle and make the case that a society built around nonprofits helping those who are in need is a much easier way to organize society than through government. Now, it should be noted that I do this public affairs show called Now Hear This, where most of these interviews are, I do these interviews for the weekend show and then podcast it. So there is a Now Hear This podcast feed with more interviews if you're interested. I reached out to probably a dozen nonprofits and a dozen government agencies, and every single one of those nonprofits responded back to me. Only one of the government agencies responded back to me with the, I asked, do you have someone that I can talk to or interview about the state's suicide hotline? And they replied, can you explain what you're specifically looking for? So got all the interviews from the nonprofits and none of the interviews from government, state, and local agencies. So there you go. I don't know what that means, but take it for what it's worth. All right. So without further ado, which is the most common phrase in podcasting, without further ado, here are my interviews with nonprofits that will give you a good idea of what's happening on the ground. Welcome to Now Hear This. I'm your host, Chris Spangle. Now Hear This is a conversation with leaders in Indianapolis that are working to improve the lives of Hoosiers. Our goal is to empower you to join in their work and make a difference while informing you about the unseen aspects of life in Indiana. If you miss an episode, you can listen via podcast at nowhearthisindy.com. Today, I am talking to Maggie Owens of the Indiana Center for Prevention of Youth Abuse and Suicide. Their website is indianaprevention.org. And April is Child Abuse Prevention Month. And unfortunately, in the middle of the COVID crisis, as we heard from our friends at the Children's Bureau, child abuse is not rising, but certainly it could be. And so, Maggie, as we first, thank you for being here. And second, we've heard from Kids Voice and Children's Bureau that child abuse may be increasing, but we're not seeing that necessarily in the numbers. What are you seeing out in the community?
I would definitely agree with those other two organizations. What's interesting is that in the state of Indiana, all adults are mandated reporters. And so when kids are at school or if they're at soccer practice or if they're going to a church event, there are all of these other adults that children are seeing and experiencing in their lives that may be somebody that could be, you know, intervening if they feel that child abuse or neglect is happening. Right now, with all of these kids just at home and not having those same opportunities to see these other adults, these trusted adults that they know, there aren't the same number of reports that are being made right now. That doesn't mean that the abuse isn't happening. It's just meaning that the kids are not given that opportunity or seeing these people that they know and that they trust that they can talk to about that to make those reports to our local law enforcement and DCS agencies. Unfortunately, what we are seeing is that the cases are more severe. So when people are calling DCS or calling to law enforcement, it's because the physical need, the physical abuse or the sexual abuse is so severe that they're getting into a hospital, or a neighbor is overhearing what's happening, and so they're making those phone calls. So it's getting more, the severity of the abuse is what is causing people to be made aware, and not necessarily that kids are having those conversations with those trusted adults.
And the phone number I've got here is 800-800-5556 if you need to make a report, or you can call local law enforcement. Again, that's 800-800-5556. And I think the delicate part about making that phone call is, I think people don't, am I overreacting? Is this my place? Should I get involved? I'm not quite sure. I mean, can you give us some clarity on when you should call, what you're seeing is the truth, or, you know, what advice would you give to somebody who thinks there may be something, but they're not sure if they should get involved?
That is a great question, and I'm so glad that you asked that. So, because, you know, like I said, all of us that are adults are mandated reporters. That doesn't mean you have to have been told specific information. All you need to know is that somebody has either said something has happened, or you have a reasonable suspicion to believe that a child is in an unsafe situation. And right now, that can be anything neglectful as well. So it doesn't have to be that you know that they are experiencing some form of abuse, but if you know that their home life is not safe for them to be in at this time, that is absolutely a time to call that 800-800-5556 number. Our organization is actually offering some online training right now to try and help people see what that would look like and how to make those reports. Because if you've never made one, there's a lot of things that is overwhelming about that. So we are offering a Stewards of Children workshop throughout the month of April and beyond, just so that people, they're home right now, they're looking for things to do, they can take this online training, recognize signs of abuse and what to do if they are experiencing that. So you can find that information on our website, on our events tab, but you can get there through indianaprevention.org. And so we are offering these different web-based trainings, things that we would normally be doing in the community, you know, face-to-face, having these different kind of training opportunities. But we've had to modify it, obviously, with the, you know, shelter in place.
Talking to Maggie Owens, who is the Director of Education and Community Relations at the Indiana Center for Prevention of Youth Abuse and Suicide. Again, you can find their website at indianaprevention.org. If I take that training, what are some of the topics that you cover? What will I see if I go and visit that tab?
So when you go and you were to do this thing, this particular training, it's an interactive workbook Through Darkness to Light. So Darkness to Light is actually a different organization that has built this evidence-based curriculum. But it's really just about holding adults accountable and providing support necessary to be able to take control of situations. I mean, there's some video. It talks to survivors of child sexual abuse and, you know, people that have worked in the community in these video segments. It's really something that I have said, if you are ever around a child or ever have a child in your home or you work with children in any capacity, this is really something that reframes the way you think about how you interact with kids. It also helps you understand that some of the behaviors that you may see, so, you know, we do this for teachers a lot, you may see some behavior in your classroom that could be because they've experienced something at home. They may be acting in a way that is different. They may be expressing that they are afraid of being at home. And so we're seeing that right now. We're seeing these kids that are afraid. They've lost the stability of their school. They've lost the stability of going out into public to doing the sporting events that they want to do. So this is really a great way to reframe how you think about kids and what their life might look like.
So let's move to a different mode of thinking. If there's somebody listening right now, all right, there are a lot of parents who, you know, I talked to a friend today and she's like, I'm a single mom. I am working from home. I am teaching my kids online. I am managing the household. I'm doing all of that simultaneously. I don't have any help. I can't have any help. That's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of pressure on parents right now. There's a lot of extra tension because of stress and worry, changes in job structures, schools. So let's talk to some of those parents who are feeling some of that stress, that self-isolation. What are some tools or ways that people can manage the stress and just kind of keep their mental health together and avoid getting into a situation that escalates in a poor way? Where do you start with a conversation like that?
I think that the biggest thing to remember right now is that what we're experiencing is a lot like grief. I mean, there are the phases and the stages of grief. And it's the same thing of what we're going through. So every person has had to change so much of their daily life. So I am a mom. I am, you know, my husband and I are both working from home. We have two little kids. We're both trying to do what we have to do with their e-learning. And it is completely overwhelming. None of us signed up to do online, long-term, virtual education with our kids. That's not what we're experiencing is just so abnormal. So the big thing to remember is that if you as the parent or the caregiver or the person who is helping out with your kids at home, if you are not taking that opportunity to take some mental breaks for yourself, your kids are going to feed off of that. So if that means you need to take a second and say, guys, I have to step away for a little bit. I need to take a quick, you know, walk to the end of the driveway and back, get a quick piece of fresh air, to take those deep breaths, that's okay. And it is 100% okay to feel all of your feelings. We, in a 24-hour period of time, you're probably going to feel so many different ranges of emotions, from feeling like you don't know what's coming next, you don't know what tomorrow is going to look like, you don't know when we're going to get back to normal, but at the same time, you're loving the fact that you get to have this extra amount of time with your kids. All of that is okay. And identifying the fact that you're feeling that way, that's the first step, to take care of yourself as well as to be able to take care of your kids. But at the same time, your kids are going through their same ranges of emotion. And so to be able to have those real holistic conversations with your children, whether they are 5 or whether they are 19 still living at home, to be able to have those check-ins of, are you okay? Is there anything that you need? You know, how are you feeling about this? Asking those questions to really be able to gauge what they're feeling, how they're interpreting things, what they're struggling with. I mean, this is a great time for parents to not only connect with their kids, but connect with their spouse, connect with your own parents as well. Make that phone call. Make sure your own parents or your grandparents or your aunt and uncle are okay. I mean, they keep calling this social distancing, and I try and rephrase it as physical distancing, because socially you can still connect in all of the same ways, just not, you know, go and hug your neighbor across the street.
How do you explain something like this? I'm not sure how old your kids are, but let's say you're talking to an 8-year-old or a 12-year-old. Like, how do you explain what's going on and the death that's going on? Like, I'm not a parent, so I wonder how people would talk to their kids about this.
You know, there are a lot of great resources available on our website. We have a whole segment right now kind of geared to what's happening in our world. I mean, it has everything from how to have these conversations about big events. I mean, right now we're experiencing in our world a really big event. And so it's giving talking points of how to have those kinds of conversations. And so that's on our website, but it has everything from, you know, what to do with your kids while they're home to help, you know, balance digital learning as well as having a little bit of extra fun, making sure your online safety is there and what parents can do to be able to implement online safety, because with this remote learning, they're going to be doing a lot more stuff online. And so we have a whole segment of our website kind of directed to that. There are some other online trainings and webinars that you can access through our website as far as, you know, what to do and how to have these conversations at home.
So let's say things just get heated and very tense. How do you back down? How do you de-escalate? Give us a few tips for that.
As a parent to de-escalate, are
yes.
you asking?
Yes.
I think that the number one thing to do is give that space. So if you are feeling your blood boiling, you are feeling that you are getting hot and bothered and upset and overwhelmed, and you're trying to work and you're trying to make lunch, you're trying to get everything done, take that time to take a deep breath. Count to five. And I know that sounds so easy, but when you take that deep breath and you can feel your feet on the floor, you can feel that you can take one step in front of the other, that you can control your body. And if you, even if you're explaining that to the people in your home, like, I need to just walk away and breathe, you are showing your kids that you're solving your own problem, that you are working through those emotions before escalating to a point. I mean, I'm a parent. I have yelled at my kids. I have, you know, we've all lost our temper because we're just trying to figure this out. But then also coming back from that, after yelling at your kids, after, you know, getting extra snippy, to ask that forgiveness from them, explain to them. Like, I have had this conversation with my 9-year-old. I'm sorry, honey. This is an unknown time and we're all working through this together. I'm sorry that I raised my voice. Do you forgive me? And let's talk about it. I mean, having that opportunity to just converse and work through it. I have learned so much more from my kids in this, and I've seen their relationships with each other as well as their relationship with me and my husband change completely in a positive way, because we're taking that time to work through this together, to talk about it together, to see how we can help our neighbors. We know if we have an elderly neighbor, what can we do? How can we send somebody a card that maybe is feeling disconnected from people, and taking very intentional steps to still be connected with others?
I was in the program by asking, you know, you're in the weeds of, you know, helping prevent youth abuse and suicide, and a lot of us are not. We don't necessarily think about some of the things that you work at on a daily basis. So what should everybody know that you just kind of see on a daily basis that you just go, I wish everybody knew this?
Ooh, that's kind of a good one. As far as the suicide prevention goes, you know, we are, as well as seeing the rise of severe child abuse, we're also seeing a rise of suicide attempts and suicide completions right now. People are in a home that maybe isn't the most stable, and they're not having that opportunity to talk. The biggest thing I think that we need to think about with our mental health is really asking, if you are seeing somebody struggling, to be able to ask that question of, are you okay? Are you thinking of hurting yourself? Are you thinking of harming yourself? Do you have a plan? Do you have any kind of means? Because just asking that question can truly stop somebody who's having a mental health crisis, stop that trajectory. By asking the question and then being able to identify if they do need help and what to do. That I think is something that often gets misrepresented in the media. People think that by asking the question, you're planting the seeds in the mind of someone, but really it's opening the door of communication where they can say, you know what? Yes, I am having a really hard time. And yes, I do need help. We have another program that we are offering online called QPR, and that's another one that you can get to from our website and take some online, you know, virtual learning about how to ask the question, how to persuade somebody to stay alive, and also refer them to get to the help that they need. So many amazing things are happening with telehealth and teletherapy right now that you can still have access without having to leave your home.
Maggie Owens, Director of Education and Community Relations for the Indiana Center for Prevention of Youth Abuse and Suicide. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. I love to be able to share what we're doing and ways to connect with people.
I am speaking today with Ben Harvey, who is the CEO of Indiana Primary Healthcare Association. Of the Indiana Primary Healthcare Association. I would imagine, Ben, that it's probably a busy time for you and your association, is it not?
It is a wildly busy time for us and the community health centers across the state of Indiana.
Well, let's start with who you are, what your organization does. What is the Indiana Primary Healthcare Association?
The Indiana Primary Healthcare Association is a member association for the 35 federally qualified health centers and federally qualified health center lookalikes, which are also known as community health centers here in the state of Indiana. So we represent them. We provide them with education, training, technical assistance, and collectively those health centers serve around 600,000 low-income, vulnerable Hoosiers in the state of Indiana.
Okay, so tell us what a community health center is for those of us who don't know.
Sure, yeah. So a community health center is a primary health care clinic. So they provide outpatient ambulatory primary health care and medical, behavioral health, and dental services to underserved populations in the state of Indiana and across the nation. Across the nation, they serve around 30 million low-income or uninsured, underinsured, underserved Americans. Here in the state of Indiana, we serve about 600,000. But they're community-driven, so the boards of the CHCs have to be made up of at least 50% of patients. So you have to actually be receiving services from that clinic. They're meant to be community-based services. They're meant to receive anybody regardless of their ability to pay. So people that are uninsured or on Medicaid are welcome to come in at any time. And they're, again, driven to serve and provide primary health care services. So we have them in Indiana from, I've heard someone say, from lake to river. So from up in the far northwest to the far southeast. So they're fairly ubiquitous.
So when you talk about the most vulnerable Hoosiers or people needing care, who are some of the people that show up to those community health centers? What does that look like? And maybe the better way to phrase this is, if someone is listening right now, how do they know if they qualify to visit one of these health centers?
Yeah, so there's really no qualification. I mean, anybody can come in. They accept anybody, again, regardless of their ability to pay. They generally end up serving. They're designed to reach populations and reach people who otherwise may not be able to access care. So there's a federal partnership that goes along with the community health center model generally, in that you receive federal dollars to support efforts in providing primary care services to underserved populations. So again, the doors are open to anyone, but you're generally going to see populations that are unlikely to access care through other mechanisms. And most of the health centers here in the state of Indiana have long histories. So HealthNet here in downtown Indianapolis, they've been serving since, I believe, the late 60s, early 70s. And a lot of these organizations grew out of local, very localized need, and then have just gradually grown beyond to serve more and more patients within their broader communities. So yeah, again, the doors are open to anyone, and generally there's not going to be slapped on the side of the building, this is a community health center. They're going to go by names like HealthNet, Eskenazi Health Center, for example, HealthLink up in Northwest Indiana. They have their own organizational names, but the CHC, the Community Health Center, is just generally a trade name, a trade designation that we go under, which is similar to the word hospital. Hospitals, it's got a defined form, but you're not going to necessarily call it a hospital. You're going to call it Parkview or Community or something like that. That's similar to Community Health Centers in the state of Indiana. So again, they serve about 1 in 5 Hoosiers who are on Medicaid. They serve a lot of low-income communities. They serve a lot of racial and ethnic minorities. Of the 600,000 patients that Community Health Centers serve, a little over half are racial or ethnic minority. So serve a large number of folks in the African-American communities here in the Indianapolis area and also up in the region, especially around Gary. So it's a pretty diverse group of folks and very committed to the idea of serving the underserved and providing high quality primary care services to patients.
Is it just, you know, when I think of healthcare, I think in the listener's mind, my mind, you think checkups, I'm sick, I need antibiotics or whatever. But when you say care, what are the range of services that these community health centers cover?
Yeah, so it's primary care. So it's tip to tail primary care. So you're going to do anything like you just said. It's not, they're not like minute clinics or quick clinics or urgent care, though some may have some urgent care facilities. They're really designed to be that medical home for folks. So taking care of someone from, you know, birth to death. So taking care of patients, you know, pregnant moms, taking care of little kids, taking care of older adults, across the spectrum of needs. So that's what they're designed to do. They're also designed to connect you to resources you may not otherwise be able to. So it's not just, you know, we know that the individual's health is not just confined to the healthcare services they receive. It's confined to, it's affected by other areas like transportation. Do you have adequate transportation? Do you have a job? Do you have adequate housing? And health centers are designed to be able to treat and deliver services to the whole person, you know, not just necessarily what can occur within the clinic's walls, but also to connect to resources in the broader sense. And that's really the design. The design of it, again, is to be based in a community, not just from a typical, you know, physician-patient relationship, though that's one of the primary things that they do, but also to provide services to the broader individual's needs.
Be it oral care,
absolutely. Behavioral health. That's exactly right. Yeah. These are things you can't separate someone's brain from their body. That's indicative of the model that health centers have. So yes. So access to dental services as well. Typically that's done, you know, dental services in the state of Indiana, the vast majority are done by individualized dentists, and the health centers are trying to integrate that piece into the medical services and behavioral health services to be able to treat the whole person.
So, you know, obviously we're in the middle of a pandemic, and I have talked to some people who think for whatever reason, I was talking to one friend and she said, you know, my son's black, he can't get medical care. They probably would turn him away if I went to the hospital. And I said, I don't think that that's true. So can you help me speak to that? Because, you know, I think there's a lot of people who are uninsured who often think I can't get care. And yeah. Or they think I have these symptoms, I can't go to the hospital. I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is the exact opposite.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, so I wouldn't want to wipe away the longstanding inequities that African Americans have faced in the state of Indiana and across the United States. And myself, you know, growing up in a smaller rural town, Fairmount in Grant County, you know, it's difficult when you. You don't have a local hospital or you don't have a local provider accessing services. And I can understand some of the barriers that folks face. And that's the thing about the pandemic now that we're facing is that you're seeing the inequities that were already in the system and the failings of the healthcare system in Indiana and in the United States. They just get exacerbated by something like this. And so I can understand the hesitancy, but certainly from a community health center perspective, our doors are open to anyone, regardless of, you know, race, ethnicity, ability to pay. There are providers out there. I know of no hospital in the state of Indiana that would turn you away based on race or really ability to pay based on, you know, the situation that we're in. We have a good working relationship with the Indiana Hospital Association, and they're pretty focused on taking care of every Hoosier. And so I would say, yeah, if you need care, certainly you're welcome in a community health center and you're welcome in a hospital across this state. Don't be afraid to go in and get care. Don't be afraid to reach out to a provider. You're not going to get turned away in this sense.
Speaking to Ben Harvey, who is the CEO of the Indiana Primary Healthcare Association. You're listening to Now Hear This. I'm your host, Chris Spangle. Obviously, with the pandemic raging, the need for care is immense. And I imagine community health centers are on the front lines like most hospitals are. My mom is an RN and she's out in Hendricks County. They're obviously being hit hard. I mean, so what is being done differently at a lot of the community health centers to help fight the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the big things is telemedicine. We're seeing big implementation, big increases in the amount of folks that are using telemedicine. You know, the state of Indiana has done something that I think is pretty beneficial. So it allows telemedicine to occur similar to this right now, where you're seeing someone virtually, or also at the same time, you can do it over the telephone to connect to your doctor. So we're seeing some really nice policy changes that are opening up doors that may not otherwise be open. And we've seen providers, you know, increase the amount of telemedicine visits they're doing by two or three times. And I think it presents a great opportunity when you're being told, you know, stay home, don't leave, isolate yourself in your home, except for essentials. There's a lot of fear that goes into, so for example, I have a young son with Down syndrome, and he had an accident in the last week or so, and he had injured his lower leg. And there was real fear as to how we're going to get that taken care of. You know, if you take a kid that has immunocompromised state and you put him into a hospital, there's real fear there. My wife and I had to make a decision that wasn't easy to make. We eventually had to take him in because he had to get an X-ray, but I can understand folks' fear with that. If you're in a compromised situation, I can understand the fear of leaving your house. So something like telemedicine, which is what our health centers are really buying into, and I know a number of hospital systems as well in the state are, it's a great way to connect to your provider because your diabetes doesn't stop, your asthma doesn't stop, any of the health conditions that you have, they don't stop because of a pandemic, because of COVID. So this is a great way to connect to your providers. And if you need to reach a provider, I think it's a great mechanism to establishing a relationship that's going to exist hopefully beyond just the pandemic, to address needs that you have now and also address needs you have.
And I'm not going to lie to you. I'm somewhat of a hypochondriac. And so when all this started and the allergy season was beginning and I was a little worried, we just interviewed the pathogens unit at IU Health. And she told us about their app, the IU Health app, the virtual screening app. And I called it totally free. She helped walk me through it. I won't discuss my personal details on the air, but yeah, I think that to me was a great comfort, and it was free, and it was super easy to use.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a really easy thing to do. You know, the interesting thing is, too, we've seen from there's the provider side where the providers are trying to do it, but what you just described from the patient side, everybody, I think, is now into the idea of trying to connect. So the barriers that you would classically assign to a technological adoption, something like, hey, older folks aren't going to use this. I think there's a lot of benefits to it. And really, I think long-term benefits, like you just said, you know, when flu season comes around next year, if your doctor's able to connect to you virtually, why not do that? And instead of going into the clinic to get checked, I think there's some real serious benefits to it. And I think health centers are seeing that. Patients are seeing that. I think the system's going to see this, the system in air quotes, is going to see that long term. And I think this is going to end up becoming a more accepted mode of delivery of healthcare services and receipt of healthcare services.
Another thing that's out there that I've seen a lot of is, oh, the numbers of the COVID deaths are overinflated. That if you get in a car accident and you die, then they're going to mark you as a COVID death. Can you walk us through the process of somebody who unfortunately passes away from COVID, is marked as a COVID death? Who makes that decision? And can you speak to that a little bit? Kind of clarify for those of us who are not really sure how these numbers are actually calculated.
Yeah, that's a great question, you know, and I know, you know, Dr. Box at the state would be able to speak really well to this because they keep the birth and the death records, and they manage all of these things, and they're not managed, you know, it's not as if you're sent into a black box or some random person off the street makes this decision. We're used to work for the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services, and in the public health field, this is an area of intense focus and clarification, trying to manage death records and find out how someone died, all those types of things. So I want to say that it's not always crystal clear. But that being said, the person that marks on your death record how you died is generally not someone who is, again, has no concept of what's going on, right? So it's generally a physician. It may be a county coroner in some instances. This is someone that has some knowledge and is making the best judgment that they can make at that time based on how you died. So it's not, again, this isn't some politician coming in or someone that is obviously trying to benefit from inflating numbers, though I'm not quite sure how anyone benefits from inflating numbers right now. It just doesn't seem conceivable to me. Also, too, I mean, the thing to remember here is that there are probably a great number of folks here that are dying of COVID-19 or maybe potentially having some of those issues that are just unknown. Don't have a diagnosis because testing's not as widespread. So the numbers, not to sound scary, the numbers may actually be higher than what they otherwise look at this point, because we're not testing as frequently or as widespread as what we otherwise could have been. So I would say, again, I don't think there's any reason to drum up a conspiracy theory based on the number of deaths from COVID-19. I think there's some, there's no hoax. There's no driving political force behind this. No one's winning from folks dying of COVID-19, and the decisions around someone's death and how someone's died is not done by folks who have no idea what they're doing. It's typically done by experts, typically done by physicians, by someone who's either treated that patient or knows that patient. And then that is taken into the State Department of Health and managed and then reported on. So again, I feel confident in the numbers that we have, and I don't see any indication that someone's trying to, again, win something or make this a bigger story than it otherwise isn't. I don't see any indication of that.
So why do you think that this hits people with pre-existing conditions? Why is it, what about the disease exacerbates some of those other things? Why is it hitting people with diabetes and high blood pressure harder? Do you know that?
I don't. I wouldn't want to speak to that aspect of the physiological aspect of it. From a social aspect of it, though, I can certainly see where it is. If you're, you know, if we're seeing across the nation, and I'm not sure, I haven't seen that the state of Indiana has released any demographic information beyond age and location. But typically people with pre-existing conditions or individuals of color, racial ethnic minorities, you're typically going to see higher rates of uninsurance. If they're in a rural area as well, you're typically going to see lower access to healthcare services. So you're taking someone that's already vulnerable and exposing them to a disease that we don't have a solid treatment for, is moving very fast. You can see, I think, to a great degree, if you already have vulnerable populations and you expose the whole population, everybody in the state to a virus like this, the individuals who are going to face the brunt of it are the ones that are vulnerable. I think you see that obviously with nursing homes, you see that with minority populations here in the state, you see it to some degree too with rural populations. There were some issues down in Batesville, I know. So yeah, that really is the driving force from a social perspective. From a physiological perspective, I'd leave that to someone that's far better trained and capable than I am with that. If you've talked to somebody at IU, I'm certainly not going to jump on.
We'll have people go to their local community health center and ask that. So final question is, you know, what do you see every day that you just wish people understood better?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the answer would be that the thing I see most frequently now is that, you know, people need to maintain that connection to their primary care provider. So we're seeing a lot of people stay away from clinics. A lot of people not want to come in. Exactly to what my personal situation is and what you said as well, Chris, is that, you know, I think there's a real fear, and rightfully so, of coming into a clinic, coming into a hospital, coming into a community health center. So know that there are options available. That's what I would say. Know there are ways to connect virtually to your physician, and know that the issues that you face are not ones that go away just because there happens to be another virus on the street right now. So I would really encourage folks to make those connections and utilize the resources they have available. As well, what you spoke about earlier, if you're in a situation where you don't have insurance or you don't have typical access to care, there are providers that are there. The community health centers around the state of Indiana, again, from the lake to the river, they're there and they're willing to accept you as a patient and to provide you the services that you need. So don't be afraid and don't think that there isn't care available, because there certainly is.
If people want more information on the Indiana Primary Healthcare Association, where can they go?
They can go to our website, so indianapca.org, again, indianapca.org. Our website's there, and we also have a function on there that has a find a health center. So if you're interested in finding a local health center or what services may be available, you can type in your street address, and it'll pop up local health centers that are close to you.
All right, Ben Harvey, CEO of the Indiana Primary Healthcare Association, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for your time. Appreciate it very much.
Today, I'm talking to Jason Chenoweth, who is the CEO of Outreach Inc., and that is an organization that deals with youth experiencing homelessness. Jason, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, thanks, Chris. I'm honored to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about Outreach Inc.? What do you do? Your website is outreachindiana.org, and if people went there, what would they find? What are some of the services that you offer to the community?
Yeah, Outreach is an organization that's been in Indy. We've been around about 23 years, and we work in a pretty specific section of our community. We work with and walk with teenagers and young adults who are homeless. So we work with anybody between the ages of 14 and 24, and the youth that we serve and help tend to be homeless on their own. So these aren't young people who have a mom or a dad and are on the streets. These are youth who have found themselves completely by themselves. And so we do everything from just trying to provide basic needs of food and clothing and, you know, shampoo, to providing laundry services and showers to help them finish school or get employed, go to college, find an apartment, different pieces, try to walk with them as they work their way, hopefully, out of the situation of being homeless.
How does someone find themselves in that situation?
You know, Chris, that's the million-dollar question, and rarely is it as easy of an answer as we want it to be. You know, it's interesting because a lot of times I've had opportunities when I've told people what I do, and they've actually looked at me and said, "There are no homeless youth in Indy." And you know, I kind of paused for a second, going, "You do know what I just said my job is," you know, but I understand that because homeless youth aren't seen. You know, they're not panhandling, they're hiding. And part of that is because people become homeless for hundreds of different reasons. You really can truly be someone who's employed and working hard and still become homeless. You can be mentally healthy and become homeless. You know, we have youth who, you know, I think of one young man we have who's been with us for a few years who was from out of state. His grandfather and some family members came to Indianapolis and left him here as a kid and went back home. And he just found himself homeless. I've met young people who, you know, I met a man from the East Coast whose mother moved out here to be with a guy that she met online. And he had been in a gang on the East Coast and wanted to get his life straight. So he moved to Indianapolis. And by the time he made his way here, the man had kicked his mom out. She was homeless, had nowhere for him. And so he came to us and goes, I'm homeless in a city where I know nobody. What do I do? You know, we have young people who are in a situation where their family just is in poverty. They're multi-generational poverty. They've been in poverty for, you know, generation after generation. And they may be the oldest sibling. And the family just can't afford to take care of everyone. So the oldest one voluntarily will move out onto the streets by themselves so that the family can still receive, you know, the subsidy help from them and not have to spend money on them. So they just move out and find their own way. And a lot of these youth continue to go to school every day, try to graduate. They go to college. They get a job. But they just don't have the resources that they need to be safe and secure.
If you were to put a number on it, like how many people do you serve? How many people would you estimate that fit your criteria of homeless youth between 14 and 24 in Indianapolis?
Yeah, you know, every year we work with about 500 youth. Some of those come one time and need help once, and then they're off again on their own. Others are at our drop center, you know, 3-4 times a week. The numbers are very hard to come by just because, like I said, they, you know, a homeless youth doesn't raise their hand and tell you where they are. In fact, if they're under 18 and homeless in our state, they're considered a runaway, and being a runaway is illegal. So they really have to keep a low profile. And so the estimates that we've seen are somewhere in the area of 2,000 homeless youth and young adults in Marion County. You know, the point in time counts that we do, where they try to estimate that every year, kind of change. But the last few years, that's been the rough number that's been hovered around is what we think there are.
So I would guess that that 14 to 18, where that's illegal, being a runaway, the experience in, for instance, the immigrant community is because of illegality, they don't want to pop up and get services, and they're at a higher likelihood of being trafficked or abused. Is mm-hmm. that, is that the same in this category?
It definitely can be.
Yeah.
You know, we have two sides to our organization. One side really works out of our drop center that we have. We have a building on New York Street, East New York, just outside of downtown, that we have a lot of youth, 375 youth a year will come through the doors there. And then we have a team that works in the local public high schools with youth who are identified as homeless. A lot of those youth are, they say they're staying with friends. The phrases you'll hear are doubled up or couch surfing. So they're bouncing from place to place, floor to floor. And by being off the street and being in school, showing up, they can kind of stay under the radar and stay engaged. It definitely can be a very dangerous place. Just because they're not on the street doesn't mean they're safe at all. Trafficking is a big issue. It looks a little different in that these youth will end up, some of them, a minority of them, will end up trading sex for a place to stay. So they're moving around, but they're still in that situation. Then we have homeless youth who just are in the stereotypical trafficking situation where they don't have any freedoms. So we see those things for male and female youth for sure. And then it varies. Some of them are underground and keeping quiet. Some of them are up front and speaking up and trying to change things. There's a youth advisory council that some of our youth sit on, and they meet with the mayor and talk to different organizations and try to bring change. So there's a broad spectrum to how the youth deal with it.
Unfortunately, there's such an amount that broad spectrum exists. We're talking to Jason Chenoweth, who is the CEO of Outreach Inc. Their website is outreachindiana.org. So the pandemic is obviously at the forefront of everyone's mind, and I'm sure it's on the forefront of the mind of the people that you serve. How is this affecting, those experiencing homelessness under the age of 24?
Yeah, it's, again, because we don't see them, it's hard to gauge that. But as we talk to the youth face-to-face as we can, there's some things that are pretty easy to see. So if you have a youth who's living in a shelter, if they're old enough, 18 or above, and they're in a shelter, typically on a given day when they come out, they have to have somewhere to go. The shelters don't let them stay through the day for safety reasons. And so they leave the shelter in the morning and they have to go and find somewhere to be throughout the day. Some of them were employed with service industry jobs. A lot of them work hard to try to support themselves. Those jobs evaporated pretty quickly in this process. A lot of them have had a hard time getting accepted for unemployment for different reasons. So, then after that, you go, okay, so where does someone go? If you go downtown, you see the signs, no public restrooms, no loitering. And I understand those signs and why they have them. But there are places that homeless youth could go and be safe and have a place to be. The public libraries were one of them, bus stops, different places. Well, all of those places have closed pretty quickly. And so we ended up in a situation where with a youth who's trying to take care of themselves, living out of a shelter, now during the day, they have nowhere to be. There's nowhere they can go that's safe. So they're struggling with that issue. Food security is a growing issue very, very quickly in it's across the country, but in our city, it is a very real issue. Really, delivering food had become one of the smaller things that we had done as an organization. We had honestly scaled back over the last few years because there was a lot of opportunities for people to get food. Our youth were able to get enough employment to feed themselves. And we have actually had to start a food delivery program almost from scratch instantly. We've been working with Shepherd Community, Second Helpings, and some different churches and nonprofits have came in to volunteer as drivers. And so we went from giving out very little food on a weekly basis. We did meals once a day, and we had some grocery bags we would give out, to within a week, we had to scale up a delivery service. And in the first week, we delivered over 200 grocery boxes and meals. And we know that number is going to begin to climb quickly. I mean, that was just with the names we knew to ask. Right. That was without any promotion on the street at all. So we're looking at continuing that program throughout the summer. Even once we open everything back up, many of us get the opportunity to go back to work in our offices. We're eating lunch out at a modified way again. The food scarcity issue is going to continue for our community for months. And so that has been a huge change. And, you know, talking to Shepherd, talking to Second Helping, the different food banks, it's interesting because as I've talked to some of the leaders of those places, even though a lot of the volunteer-run food distribution sites, whether it's a church that had a food pantry that would give out food or different places, a lot of those are closed. The volunteers aren't coming. They're staying home. So there's less distribution points. But the city, the organizations that give out food are giving out 2, 3, 4 times as much food, even though they have a third of the distribution points open. I mean, the need is just really big.
Have you heard in these conversations, you know, I went to Meijer for my weekly shopping trip yesterday, and there was still, I mean, it was still pretty bare. I mean, we're mm-hmm. a month into this, and, you know, Smithfield shutting down in South Dakota is going to put a strain on things like pork. That's only going to continue to increase. Have you heard from Shepherd or Second Helpings or some of these folks, like, is there... are they having a tough time finding food like many of us are having a tough time finding some of these products? And B, is there something that the listener can do to help alleviate the, you know, if those of us who have extra food that we overbought 3 weeks ago, how do we get that to people like you or to Shepherd? How do we solve some of the food security issues?
Yeah, that's a great question. These are issues for everybody. So, you know, with some of the shutdowns in the meat processing plants, everybody's kind of steeling ourselves for the fact that we're not going to have access to that meat the way we have. I don't think it's a panic situation. It's just going to be less. And so a lot of the food pantries and the distribution points, you know, really historically kind of live off the excess of food that we have. And a lot of the donations that have come to someone like Second Helpings or different places is from the excess food that's been produced that isn't used. And with that not being the case, that tightens everybody's belts on the supply line of this. I think that the things that you can do to get involved, if you, have a nonprofit that you are a partner with or a supporter of or that you are aware of, just checking to see, are they distributing food right now? And if they are, you know, whether you want to check with them and see if they want to take physical donations of food, you know, a lot of organizations are, we do. People can drop that off, and still every nonprofit that's up and running right now has figured out the social distancing issue. Another thing you can do is just any type of financial donation, and you can tag it for an organization saying you want it to go to food distribution. For most nonprofits, the resources that are coming into the nonprofit has decreased, and the demands and needs of that nonprofit have increased. And so, if you aren't sure who to go to, Second Helpings is a great one. They take care of a lot of nonprofits in town, so you can go straight to them. If you see there's been some large gifts to them, but they operate on such a scale, those large gifts go away really quick. They get used for the city. So, you know, I think you can donate physical items if you have them, or if you want to, you know, like we have on our website, a most important needs list that we update all the time. You can go to most websites and find what they need, buy it, drop it off. Anything you can do. The thing I would encourage you is don't assume that you can't do enough to make a difference. It takes our whole city right now to help. This is a systematic problem. This isn't something that just happened because of COVID-19. It's an issue we always have. It's just bigger right now. And so it takes all of us just pulling together to do anything we can to help our community.
So you mentioned couch surfing and, you know, obviously if you're homeless, the advice of go home, you know, let those who have contracted the disease, you know, go home, yeah. Get some rest, get plenty of fluids, just take it easy, watch Netflix. If you're homeless, then you don't really have that opportunity. And, you know, the economic situation, you've also mentioned, you know, they're the first ones to get cut in an economic downturn like this. So is there a place, is there some sort of system that's being set up? I mean, how are we handling those who contract the disease in the homeless community within Indianapolis?
You know, we're really fortunate in Indianapolis when you compare us to a lot of other large cities across the country, and that our city and local governments have been aware of the issue of homelessness and have been working hard for quite a while to try to put in place some large answers and to help out our community. And so, you know, whether it's the mayor's office or commissioners or whoever, they've been working hard at this. There have been some very quick steps that were taken. There is a place in town where when someone does test positive from our homeless community, there is a place that they can be taken for isolation and care. The challenge for us is, you know, especially like I said, for us working with youth, is to get them to go get tested if they get sick. And because a lot of the folks who are homeless, they tend to walk around with a lot of the symptoms that we talk about of COVID-19 every year. I mean, you know, it's very difficult to stay healthy when you're on the street, when you don't have good nutrition, you don't have a safe place to sleep, you don't have adequate clothing. I mean, all of those things contribute to a lack of health on a regular basis. So while the city has done a very good job of working hard on this, it is still a concerning issue. You know, if you check like Wheeler, if you look at the stories they've had of how they've been trying to, how do you figure out social distancing and yet care for as many people as you can in a shelter? This is a large scale challenge. Shelters are not set up for social distancing. You know, the idea is let's provide housing for as many people as we can on an emergency basis. So they've had to really work on this. So this issue of you know, COVID-19 and how do we deal with it as a community, it's an incredible challenge when you move into the homeless community on how to work with it. And that brings a lot of fear to the folks who are homeless. You know, again, whatever your stereotype is of someone that you think is homeless, I would encourage you broaden it, because as you get to know people and you hear their stories, while the stereotypes are part of the community, it's a small part of the community. Most of the folks who find themselves homeless, whether they're 15 years old or 50 years old, have a ton in common with you and I, and are very similar in how they see the world and approach the world. And, as much as this scares us, it's scaring them. And so anything we can do to help, you know, it helps our whole community.
So final question for Jason Chenoweth, who is the CEO of Outreach Inc. Their website is outreachindiana.org. If you'd like to go get information from them and help volunteer or donate, and you can find that information at outreachindiana.org. I always ask this at the end of every show. What is the thing that you see on a daily basis that most of us may just not know and take for granted, and you just go, wow, I wish everybody knew this?
You know, that's a really insightful question. I think the thing that surprises people the most is if you would stop by our program center, our drop center, on a day when the youth are all there. You know, there's 40 or 50 youth in the building. and you come in and you go, okay, I'm going to go spend some time with teenagers and young adults who are homeless. They lack all the basic necessities that I take for granted. And you kind of have this idea of what you're going to walk into. And then you walk into the room and there is so much laughter and there's so much hope and there's community that forms really fast. And so many of the young men and women are just incredibly smart and gifted and really generous people. I mean, there's always challenges and problems in any group, but I never cease to be amazed at how often when I'm in the building, the amount of laughter that I hear. And you think about how often maybe we laugh in a given day. And we would say, well, it's because of all the stress and challenges. But then you spend time with these young people and how much hope and laughter they have in the face of challenges far greater than what you and I face, Chris. I think that's the thing I wish people could see, because it changes the face of homelessness for you when you meet these people and get to know them and see what's happening. There's a lot of potential and hope. It just takes people being involved on a relational basis.
Jay Chenoweth, CEO of Outreach, Inc. Their website is outreachindiana.org. Thank you for joining me.
Hey, thanks, Chris. I really appreciate it.
On the line is one of my good friends here to discuss a very tough topic, and that is Lael Hill, president of the Indiana Coalition for Crime Victims' Rights. Lael, thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate everything that you do for victims of sexual and physical violence. And unfortunately, with the pandemic going on and our conversations with some folks, it sounds like the problem is increasing, even if we don't necessarily see it in numbers.
It is. Yes, it's incredibly concerning for myself and all my colleagues in the community. With the stay at home orders and the quarantine, when you pair that with the stress of unemployment and uncertainty and health problems, and you already maybe had violence in the family home to begin with, it's going to escalate things, because research basically shows that violence can be escalated by stress related to unemployment issues. So that being said, with child abuse as well. The numbers are increasing in the domestic violence community, but also for children as well. So we're pretty concerned.
Yeah, and one of the sad ways that it popped up is Officer Breanne Leith was killed while responding to, and this is something that I don't think people understand, is that if police respond to a domestic violence call, it's incredibly dangerous for everyone. So we are sad for Breanne Leith's family and all of IMPD. But can you speak to that? I mean, that was just such a tragic event.
Yeah, you know, my heart goes out to Officer Breanne Leith's family and the entire community, and to her comrades, and not only with just IMPD, but the Marion County Sheriff's Department and the dispatchers and all of her colleagues that have worked close with her in the community. It's just so sad. She was so young, and I think law enforcement officers are heroes. I work closely with them. I've had to personally ask them to go pick victims of domestic violence up to bring them to local shelters in our community, and they run towards violence. When we as citizens are in fear of violence or we're scared, our initial reaction is to flee. But law enforcement officers actually have to walk towards the violence, and she did. And she did as such a hero, and she made the ultimate sacrifice, and we're so sorry for her loss. And just thankful for her courageous service. And that being said, ICCVR, our organization, is working on becoming what's called a vicarious trauma-informed organization, in that we are going to specialize in making sure that we also provide services to law enforcement officers, victim advocates, forensic nurses, attorneys who might be impacted by the crime from working on the job. And so we want to make ourselves available for any first responder, law enforcement officer, or victim advocate that may have felt personally impacted by the loss of Officer Breanne Leith. And we have services available for them as well, one-on-one emotional support, and we can connect them with resources and find them a vicarious trauma-informed therapist as well.
Tell me about the broad range of services that the Indiana Coalition for Crime Victims' Rights provides. Tell us what you do.
Sure. Yeah. So I started out working as a victim advocate in traffic crimes, and then I switched to be a rape crisis worker. But what I've seen as a victim advocate the last 6 years around the state of Indiana is that, one, I felt like traffic crime victims were underserved. So we're talking about your drunk and drugs driving victims that lose their life in a very violent crash, in a violent manner that could have been avoided should these people have just used Uber or designated a non-drinking driver. So one, I wanted to make sure that those victims were served too. So I started ICCVR. Two, I also were seeing that there are victims of violent crimes throughout all 92 counties, and there's some in rural areas of Indiana that they don't have a Julian Center, or they don't have, you know, Families First or Legacy House. And so I wanted to make sure that victims of violent crime, regardless of what the crime is, were properly served, even in the underserved communities in the rural areas of Indiana that didn't have a lot of resources. And when I say served, I really mean meeting with them and discussing with them the criminal court process, what investigations look like, what they can expect moving forward after the crime through the criminal court process. And then most importantly, what their victims' rights are. So they have the right to confer with the prosecutor. They have a right to be notified of court hearings. They have a right to be present at any hearings. And so I really wanted them to take control back, because so often victims aren't in control when the crime happened to them. And so my idea is that I want to do everything I can to give them control back in their lives. And they do that by taking control of what they can do in the criminal justice system by participating.
Yeah, I'm constantly referring people to you because you do you provide such a necessary service for people, because the Byzantine nature of our system requires and necessitates a lawyer oftentimes, and that can be very expensive. And a lot of the people that you know, I've referred you to don't have any money and they can't afford a lawyer, or they're not sure if they should get a lawyer, and they're not sure if they should have some of that expense. And so sometimes it's helpful to have somebody like Lael at the Indiana Coalition for Crime Victims Rights to act as a shepherd through the process, or just to have a conversation with somebody to give some advice. So I think what you do is very necessary because of just the way that the system is set up.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I appreciate that. And definitely I appreciate your referrals. You know, we want to make sure that all victims of violent crime are served if they need services. And so we definitely encourage referrals because we don't believe that any victim of crime should have to navigate this process alone. It's very, I'm sure, as you know, it's very daunting, exhausting. They have a lot of trauma, so they don't have good concentration. They are probably have a lot of fatigue and body aches, and especially if they're victims of, and you know, or if they have an injury related to the crime. So yeah, we really appreciate your referrals. We want to reach and serve all victims. That being said, as far as the lawyer, I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because that's another reason why I started ICCVR, is because, you know, we don't believe that any victim of crime should have to pay for an attorney to advocate for them in criminal court. It's just, they've already had so much economic hardship from the crime. They didn't choose to be victims, so they shouldn't have to have an attorney. That being said, you know, I just want to clarify too, and I've spent the last 6 years explaining this to the public, is that victims of crime are considered a witness in the case. They're not considered a party to the case. So in criminal court, is a two-party system, and the state is represented by the prosecutor, and then you have the accused that's represented by the defense attorney. And so those are the two parties that can essentially litigate in criminal court. Victims, however, are considered witnesses. And so while they can't have any control on charging decisions or plea agreements or witnesses, they do have standing to assert their victim's rights. And so if one of their victim's rights is violated or it's in question, for example, if a victim is told that they cannot attend the trial of the offender that caused this crime to them or that perpetrated this crime against them, then we would have an attorney represent them and file some sort of a motion in criminal court. And our attorney, hopefully, and that's in the making, will argue next to the prosecutor and defense attorney is why our client should be allowed to attend their trial because it's their rights. And so this is really important because victims' rights, you know, they established victims' rights in Indiana, but they never set up a way to assert them. And so essentially victims were given rights, but not an attorney to assert them. So we're working hard to find attorneys that will work with victims and us pro bono or as volunteers so that we can make sure the service delivered. As an advocate myself, what I've been doing the last 5 years as a non-lawyer is really just being a liaison between the victim and the prosecutor's office or law enforcement officer. And really just kind of stepping in and just saying what's going on and, you know, how can I help? And, you know, kind of explaining the side of the victim and trying to really do conflict resolution so that victims' rights can be enforced.
How do people get in contact with you? Do you have a website? Where can people, how can they get a hold of you?
So I'm so glad that you asked. Actually, our website's getting ready to pop up within a couple weeks, working with Dojo Creative out of South Bend. They're going to do a really good job. We have a ton of content, so it's coming up. So hopefully when that's done, I can shoot it over to you and you can update this podcast or your Facebook page with our information. Right now, we're only on Facebook, so people can find us on Facebook. You just type in Indiana Coalition for Crime Victims' Rights or ICCVR in the search bar, and our Facebook page will come up, and you can message us directly through there. But it might be a few weeks before our website comes up, as we're brand new.
And people can always get a hold of us through the contact section, and I'll put you in touch personally with Lael Hill.
Yes, please do.
Last couple questions here. The pandemic, obviously, and the stay-at-home orders make a bad situation worse for a lot of people because they're basically trapped in with their abuser. And the people that, you know, as we've heard from Children's Bureau, for instance, the mandatory reporters that would call for help, law enforcement or DCS, they're not seeing the victims of child abuse. With domestic violence, they're not leaving home. The pressure is up. We've seen a statistic that your average week would see 11 murder suicides where a husband will or wife will kill the other person and then kill themselves. That has hit 17 to 20 per week over the last 3 to 4 weeks. So we know in those death statistics that this is an ever-growing problem. So if someone is in that situation and listening, or if they have a family member that they're concerned about, what should people do? How can I would imagine, not to project, but I would think that if they were in that situation, they would feel fairly hopeless and that they have nowhere to go. Speak to that person and explain to them what their options are.
Sure. Yeah, that's definitely a good point. You know, we're just so sorry for anyone that's struggling right now and having to stay home with their abuser. Especially for children, because they really don't have anyone that's a voice for them. And usually teachers, nurses, social workers are. And so family violence is a big concern, like I said earlier, right now. And we want to make sure that everybody knows that there's still help and there's definitely still hope. The advocates in our city of Indianapolis, and I'm sure advocates around our state and country, are still working. They might be working remotely, but they're still taking calls. And so no matter what, we can get services, we can get some tips and safety planning to a victim and survivor, and we can get them in a shelter if needed. We just want to do whatever we can do to save their lives. Now, I do have some tip lines, so I definitely want to share those if I'm able to.
Absolutely.
Just pulling it up right here.
Is there a way to you know, covertly have these conversations? Because I would imagine, you know, monitoring of phones is something that a victim would be concerned about.
Definitely. You know, one thing, and I think I've seen France doing this, is that, you know, domestic violence advocates are working with pharmacies to have a victim, or to have be able to have victims create some a code word, and to train pharmacist staff on that code word, and so that they can step in and help and maybe get that person to a safe place to have that phone conversation. Also, I think, you know, advocates can be creative and work with victims and survivors on getting a plan together that keeps them really safe, but then allows them to get out of the house, maybe for an essential, you know, trip to the doctor's office or going to buy a loaf of bread. And then we can have that conversation with them as planned. I do want to say, you know, the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence has a lot of tips for victim advocates. And we also have a national domestic violence hotline that we can share that victims can certainly call. And that number is 1-800-787-3224. And this is interesting because, you know, at least in my time that I've been practicing, we've not seen a quarantine like this or stay at home orders. So there's not really many best practices out there yet. So hopefully out of this, we can create some best practices. And that way, if this happens again in the future, we'll really be prepared to help victims of domestic violence. So I'll be interested to see what kind of best practices come out of this.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Lael Hill, president of the Indiana Coalition for Crime Victims' Rights. We'll put some of those numbers in the show notes so people can check that out if they want to get help or help a family member or friend. Please don't hesitate to get help if you're in that situation, or reach out to somebody that you are concerned about. Lael Hill, thank you so much for joining me.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
As you know, the restaurant industry has been hit hard through these shutdowns, and there are several of them out in the community that are doing great work, and one of them is Taste Restaurant at Lucky Lou, and I have the pleasure of speaking to Casey Lunn. Casey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us, where's the restaurant? What is the restaurant? Give some details about where you're located and what you do typically.
Yeah, sure. We are located in the northwest area of Indy, so we're at 3623 Commercial Drive. We are a Chinese restaurant that serves dim sum, authentic dim sum. You know, so far we're the only restaurant who serves dim sum in the whole city. We also serve authentic Cantonese food. And, you know, we're just a family-owned business, and we're passionate about food, and we're passionate about introducing people in Indianapolis to the art of dim sum.
Now, Casey, I am an uncultured boy from Plainfield, Indiana. So can you explain to me what dim sum is? What is Cantonese food, and what is that different? How is that different than what I may have normally experienced?
Well, you know, for dim sum, you know, I like to say, tell people dim sum is like papa, so like appetizers, right? In the Chinese version of it, if you will. So, you know, mostly it's made out of, you know, meats and dumplings and, you know, and they're served in small portions. So what we do that's really unique when, you know, we're not in lockdown, is every weekend we roll out the appetizers out in steaming dim sum carts. And we go around the restaurant to every table, and the customers can have the fun of ordering the appetizers from the cart, steaming hot, you know, live. So it's actually, you know, for us, dim sum in Cantonese culture is an epic event on Sunday. You know, I think in a lot of Eastern culture, you know, maybe we're not great at expressing our feelings in words, so mm-hmm. we express our feelings in food. And so being around family at a table on a Sunday, you know, eating and talking hours on end is how we really create unity and harmony in our family. So it's definitely something that's very close to home. And our customers, you know, have said the same thing, that it's a very engaged activity when you have dim sum. Our food is good, you know, so we've heard. And they really have a good time, participating in this activity.
Well, expressing your feelings through food instead of words sounds very familiar to the way I grew up. So that's beautiful. Yeah. That's great. So, you know, we obviously faced a crazy situation 4 weeks ago. What were some of the first thoughts going through your mind, and how did you start to process what you might do as we entered the pandemic?
Yeah, that's a very profound question. I think, you know, like everybody else, you know, the uncertainty, you know, especially having to limit our service. And, you know, I think the first thing that crossed our mind is, you know, how are we going to survive? And then I think the next thing is, you know, we still have to go outside, you know, we're considered essential businesses, right? So, you know, how are we going to stay safe, you know? But, you know, my family is Buddhist, so, you know, in Buddhism, there's a saying that, you know, the harder the wind blows, you know, the more you can see, you know, the strength of the grass, right? So, you know, we really wanted to take this challenge on and really be determined that we're going to overcome this together, and just not give up. And, you know, so far so good. You know, we've struggled a lot. You know, we ran into issues, you know, with our landlord, you know, with being able to make rent, you know, quite frankly, we're still struggling, but, you know, our determination is, you know, we'll continue to show our care and hopefully offer some encouragement to the people of Indiana and Indianapolis through our food. And we're going to hang in there as long as we can.
So I want to ask a delicate question, because I've seen in the news that some Chinese restaurants have taken the brunt of some unfortunate comments. Have you experienced anything like that? What are you experiencing out as you're in the community delivering food?
You know, fortunately for us, we have experienced nothing but kindness. You know, I mean, I think, you know, we hear a lot of, you know, these instances profiling Asian American businesses and individuals a lot. So, you know, the concern is always there, you know, in the forefront, you know, of our minds. But, you know, for us, you know, we've had customers who, you know, would drive 2 hours from, you know, other parts of the state to get to go. And they would leave saying, you know, we just want to support you. We want to see you survive. You know, we've had so many of those instances of kindness that actually, I think the flip side of that conversation is, while there is a lot of perhaps hatred, you know, a lot of fear, a lot of frustration, the flip side that we've been seeing, people have been incredibly kind. You know, the people of Indiana have been incredibly kind to us. So we have nothing but appreciation, you know, for everyone.
That's great. That's good to hear. We're talking to Casey Lund, who is of Taste Restaurant at Lucky Lou. What are you doing differently? How are you adapting your business to operate in this new environment? What are some of the things that you're doing differently? And are you giving back to the community in any way?
Yeah. So, you know, what we're doing different is we're trying to get creative with our menu. So, you know, we're trying to constantly think of meal pairings, you know, that we can offer soon to the public. You know, we're also thinking about ways that we could maybe, like, freeze our dim sum for an instant, or maybe, like, get frozen dumplings out so that, you know, people can buy in bulk and they don't, you know, have to just come and get fresh food. They can have food that they could, like, prepare themselves, you know, from our restaurant. So these are some of the things that, you know, we're getting creative about. We're also introducing new dishes, you know, too, so we haven't stopped doing that. And some of the things that we have been doing with the community. So, my mother, who is the co-owner of, you know, Taste Restaurant, at Lucky Lou, she wanted to give back to the, medical professionals because, you know, she can really see that they're risking their lives more than we are, you know, and trying to, treat people who have COVID-19 while sacrificing, you know, their own safety. So what happened was, you know, we recently started our Instagram account. I've been following this one young woman, and I didn't know that she was a nurse, but I think about like 2 weeks ago, she posted a picture of her in face mask and a hospital gown. so I discover that, you know, she's actually a nurse. So we reach out to her. It turns out she's a critical care nurse at Community North. And she said that, you know, she's actually 26 week pregnant, and she's been working 87 hours a week because, wow, you know, they are so overwhelmed with, you know, just normal patients and people who are, you know, coming in and afraid that they have COVID-19. You know, that post moved us so much that, you know, we reached out to her and just said, you know, I don't know, it's so small, right? But can we give you like a free lunch? Because you guys probably don't have time to think about food. And she was so appreciative. So my mom was able to deliver, you know, lunch for the day for her department. So, you know, that's something that it was, again, it was really small, but it was like absolutely our honor to do that.
That's great. So if are you doing more of that? Can people help participate in providing lunches if they get in touch with you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's something that we're thinking about. We definitely want to do more in the coming weeks. So, you know, I would say people can look at our Instagram. That's where we post all of our updates. So our handle is Taste Dim Sum. And they can also check out our restaurant website, which is TasteRestaurantLuckyLou.com for any updates on, you know, donating food to medical workers.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us, Casey Lunn. Again, give that address for your website.
Sure. Our website is TasteRestaurantLuckyLou.com.
Great. Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Today, I'm talking with one of my good friends, a former coworker at the Bob and Tom Show, where we briefly worked together, Eric Totterud, who is a business development associate at Fairbanks, which is a recovery center. Eric, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
So you can find out more information about them at fairbankscd.org. But Eric, tell us, what is Fairbanks? What do you do? And what is your job there?
Yeah, so Fairbanks is an addiction treatment facility. We're on the northeast side of Indianapolis. So if anyone's familiar with the Castleton area or Community North, we are right next to Community North. Actually, this year, 2020, we're celebrating 75 years. So we're one of the oldest addiction treatment centers in the country. And we offer a full continuum service for addiction treatment, meaning everything from acute detox through residential, various outpatient levels of care down the line. Basically, if you can think of a level of treatment for substance use disorder, very good chance that we offer something like that for both adults and adolescents.
Are you comfortable sharing your story? Are you willing to talk about that? Tell us a little bit about your journey and why Fairbanks means so much to you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm actually a person in long-term recovery. So I've been sober for, about 5.5 years now. When I was about 22, I found myself over at Laverna Lodge for Men. That's the residential program up in Carmel that we have. It holds 14 men. I found myself up there after making some questionable decisions that landed me, with some depression and substance use issues. Stayed there for 4 months. Got kind of connected with the recovery community through that program, and then left and went into sober living, lived there, and basically haven't looked back, been sober a day at a time since that day. So it's something that is kind of near and dear to my heart, and if, you know, I think the big thing is if I can do it at the age of 22 and as in the mindset that I was in, I believe that that these programs can help anybody.
Yeah, and so your job there is what? Do you work with people who are going into the treatment program? Tell us a little bit about what you personally do at Fairbanks.
Yeah. So I work with a bunch of different, providers, medical providers, behavioral health providers, Department of Child Services, probation, some employers. We work with a lot of employers. I don't do as much with the employers, but we have people that do more with the employers. And I'm trying to think what some attorneys, pretty much anybody who would come in contact with somebody who's struggling with substance use disorder, you know, and needs help, I reach out to them, make sure that they're aware of what programs we do offer, criteria, and how to access these services. I kind of create a point of contact, and I'm kind of a liaison for those folks that need that come in contact with people who need help. So
in your work and in the Fairbanks organization, obviously with the pandemic, I've heard anecdotal evidence that people are struggling and having a harder time. I mean, I think all of us are struggling with some level of grief, and some people are experiencing trauma at worse levels, the economy and job loss. These are very difficult things to deal with. Everybody has a lot of feelings around a lot of things. And, you know, maybe you can speak from your own personal experience, but I wonder, what are you hearing from people who are going through the program in this time of being quarantined and locked up in your house and this just extra pressure?
Yeah, absolutely. So, first off, isolation is a huge part of, you know, addiction and substance use disorder. Oftentimes, so when if you talk about relapse, you know, you're talking about not just the actual use of that substance is kind of the end point. People think of that as being the relapse, but the relapse actually starts a lot earlier. So way before that actual use. And isolation is oftentimes the first thing that people, first indicator towards a relapse. So it is a concern. But there's definitely resources. You know, I think a big thing that for me is my heart goes out to the newcomer right now. So for me, you know, as when you reached out to me, Chris, I started thinking, oh, this will, you know, this is super easy. You know, I got all these people. I get texts multiple times a day about meetings that we're doing or whatever. But that's after 5.5 years of being connected to a recovery community. You know, the difficult thing I think would be to be a newcomer right now coming in. And what I've heard from just, and this is, you know, anecdotally, this is just what I hear from people, is how hard it is to feel really connected to the community through, especially getting connected to the community, starting off through virtual means.
So let's start with maybe some questions that a person may ask themselves to discover if they need to seek resources. Like, what are some signs? Because in all my experience with friends and family that have gone through substance abuse issues, or they're drinking too much, or they're using drugs, or things are getting out of control, it seems gradual. It's not, you know, it's not that big moment. It's, wow, I've had this behavior this many times. Maybe I have an issue. What are some warning signs that our audience may apply to themselves or the person in their household or family member in this moment that can kind of help them go, maybe I ought to talk to somebody?
Yeah, so I think that the big thing is using in the face of consequences. Yeah, I mean, it can be something gradual. It can also be, you know, you start noticing that a family member or a loved one is, you know, is distancing themselves emotionally from the family. I mean, it can be something that small, or I guess it's not small, but something that subtle. You know, it doesn't have to be a DUI or consequences in that way. But a big thing is, when somebody starts experiencing consequences and continues to use in the face of those consequences, that's kind of when I would say it's, you start looking at it as a problem and maybe talk about reaching out for some services.
Is there like, what are some other warning signs, just not just the distance, but are there some other behaviors that may be problematic?
So, of course, if they're using, if they're waking up and using, if somebody is experiencing, like signs of detox, if they have to use or drink, basically in order not to get sick, that's a big sign. That's a huge sign. And that's a big thing with opioids, alcohol, benzodiazepines, some of those substances, is really using in, to the extent where when you stop using, you're getting sick. That's when somebody needs, medical detox. And that's a big one. I think that, other ones, if a family member is drinking throughout the day, that's something I think to look at. I don't want to say everybody that has a drink, on a Saturday at noon is an alcoholic. That's not what I'm saying. But if it's something where you're noticing that this person is, is choosing to drink, or really not choosing, once it's, addiction is not really a choice. Once you're an addict, it's not really a choice anymore. But if somebody's drinking throughout the day, or using, waking up and using, I think that those are huge, huge signals. And with the emotional distance, I was kind of getting it. If they're hiding their use, if they are hiding their use, then you'll notice them being, generally emotionally, a little bit emotionally distant.
I think that those are great kind of tip offs. And how do you have that conversation with a loved one that maybe they're having a problem? Because that doesn't always seem to be an easy conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a big thing is, starting off, I think before even just approaching the person and, kind of being almost accusatory at that person, I think it's a good idea to reach out to other people who have experienced, family members who have struggled with substance use disorder. There's family support groups. And I think that number one, a family needs to start, before they even expect, their family member to really get the help and change. I think that they need to look at some of the support for themselves, and then look at their family member as well. Some of those support groups, I know Overdose Lifeline right now has family support groups for free going on. And then approaching the person, I think, and it's partly it depends on each individual, but approaching that person and, not being accusatory, not saying, hey, you're ruining my life and you're doing, right.
Passive aggressive about it, just being honest.
Yeah. Approach them in an honest way. Say, hey, look, this is how this is affecting me. And this is how it's affecting the whole family. Would you be open to maybe getting an assessment? Fairbank, we offer free assessments. It's free to pick up the phone and give us a call. And the good thing is that once you pick up the phone and give us a call, there's professionals on the other end of the phone who can kind of take some of the information that the family member is giving us, then take the information that the person struggling with substance use disorder is giving us, and then we can recommend a level of care based on the actual information. And these are people who, when we're answering the phone, we understand that there's going to be probably two different, you know, we're going to get information from two different people, and we're going to kind of dig a little bit deeper than just taking the family member's word and then taking the other person's word always, you know.
Right.
It's a little bit more complicated than that a lot of times. So I think it's always a good idea to pick up the phone and give a professional a call.
Okay, so if you want to reach out, then their phone number is 1-800-225-4673. Again, that is 1-800-225-4673, or you can go to their website, fairbankscd.org. My guest is Eric Totterud, who is a business development associate at Fairbanks. If there, in our final question here, what is the thing that you see on a daily basis that you wish people understood about the community that you serve?
Something that I see on a daily basis, something I see on a daily basis that I want people to understand about people with substance use disorder is that they're not always the homeless person living under the bridge who has a bottle in a brown paper bag. You know, this is a population. These are our friends and family members, you know, who may be struggling. I think that all too often I meet with people and I meet with professionals who, you know, I know that they have, that they're coming in contact with people that are struggling with substance use disorder. And I hate when I meet with somebody and they say, "Oh, you know, we don't even see that population here. It's, you know, really we only see people, you know, kind of white collar people who are, you know," it's like, that's not accurate. You know, this disease does not discriminate, you know, it adversely does affect certain populations, but, you know, really, the person that's struggling could be, you know, the person next door, or a friend or family member who, you know, isn't necessary, you know, who has a good education, has maybe even still has their job and, you know, still is struggling. And I think that something that's going to be interesting is seeing in, as we move past this, the amount of people who, you know, have been isolated, who are going to be probably using and drinking throughout the day, they're working from home, or they're, you know, not coming in contact with their employers or their family members. And I think that we're going to see a spike in people. I think that, like Fairbanks, for example, I think we are going to see a spike in people who are going to be coming through our doors looking for help once they get back out, and their employer or their family member starts seeing them again and start seeing that, hey, they've been, you know, they've been using, they've been drinking while they've been at home. I think that's something, and that's just my personal opinion about that.
Well, I hope that if people feel that they have an issue, or if they feel a loved one has an issue, that they do go to fairbankscd.org and get some help. And you know, it's better to the guardrails are off a little bit on a lot of different issues, and obviously this is one place to go to help get better. So, Eric, thank you so much for joining.
We have those virtual. Just real quick, we have the virtual online IOP, which is like a virtual group that, you know, people don't even have to come in to get assessed. They can give us a call and do it all over the phone. So if you're worried about getting, you know, about the pandemic, you know, and it's something that I know, even though I said, you know, people anecdotally don't feel like they connect as much via, you know, virtual groups, you know, it's really, it's a lot better than doing nothing,
Or being alone
and being at home. Yeah. Being at home alone and not reaching out. So I know we're wrapping up. I just wanted to kind of plug that real quick because I know that it's something that could help a lot of people. You know, and then there's free virtual peer-to-peer groups that are put on by the Indiana Addiction Issues Coalition. I can send you any of that information, Chris, and if any of your listeners are more interested, they can always reach out to me as well. I have a long list of free and like free resources for people, and then also resources within Fairbanks that are really helpful. So any of your listeners can always feel free to reach out to me, or I can send it over to you. So whatever you want to do with it.
Yeah, we can put that in the show notes so people can go to nowhearthisindy.com and look for this episode and then find that there, along with a link to fairbankscd.org and the phone number. Eric, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate you having me on.
Today, I'm talking to Phil May, who is the Sharing Place Coordinator at the Foundation for Lutheran Child and Family Services. Phil, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Tell us a little bit about the Foundation for Lutheran Child and Family Services. What is it?
Well, the Foundation for Lutheran Child and Family Services was founded as an orphanage on East Washington Street by a bunch of German immigrants in 1883. Fast forward about 130 some odd years, and we run the Lutherwood, the children's home, on at 16th and Ritter, and and among other programs, we also run the Sharing Place Food Pantry, which I do.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about your work at the Sharing Place Food Pantry. I'm sure that that is, the need is great right now. Give us an idea of the scope of the change between 2 months ago and today.
Well, it has been quite a bit of change and did happen rather quickly. So we used to do, client choice. We are a TFAP pantry. That's the Emergency Food Assistance Program through the United States Department of Agriculture. And so we have folks come in, we check them in, and we take their information, and then we send them around the pantry, and everybody gets a number of points to blow. You know, like mixed vegetables were 2-for-1, diced tomatoes were 4-for-1. But lately, you know, we've been doing things differently. So we moved to a curbside service sort of deal where we prepackage boxes and bring them out to folks. We ask their preference whether they'll eat pork or not, and if we've got supply, we ask them whether they want whole wheat or white bread, and it's we just thrash it out and bring it out to their cars and come back and do it over and over and over and over and over until we're done.
So do you have any kind of idea of the volume difference?
Yeah, we're doing about double. Last in 2019, we served about 945 families a month on average. I don't have the numbers in front of me right now, but for at least the last 2 days, we've served well over 100 folks. For reference, a usual Monday, in a normal day when there isn't a pandemic, we serve about 60 to 70 families. Yesterday, we did 113.
Wow.
No, yesterday, on Monday, we did 113. On Tuesdays, the record for a normal day is 117. Yesterday, we did 115. We're definitely seeing a lot more folks. We're seeing all of our regulars, of course, but we've got a lot of new faces as well.
So how does it work? If somebody is in need and they need to access your services, do they show up? Do they get a hold of you through LutheranFamily.org? How do they go about it?
We have an excellent system of word of mouth advertising, if you can call it that. Folks, we've got set hours, which is Mondays and Thursdays, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., and Tuesdays, 4 to 8 p.m., and folks can just show up. The only real requirement we have is proof of residence. We have a 9 zip code area. It's Lawrence Township, and then 46218 and 46219. So they just show up. They give us our proof of residence. We write down the household total, and then we ship them a box of food. Well, we don't ship them. We bring it out there, but...
Sure. And so where is your food sourced? I mean, what are you hearing from the people that provide your food? And, you know, I mean, I went to the grocery yesterday and food is scarce. And I know that Walmart and Meijer, they make up a lot of donations to a lot of pantries like yours.
Right.
So are they providing less? I mean, how are the sources and the provisions coming along?
You are exactly right. it is pretty wild to be reminded that we are a part of the same supply chain as everybody else. We do get lots of donations from grocery stores, specifically there's two Kroger's, a Meijer up here, and the Walmart on Pendleton Pike. And some donations are dwindling. Like, we haven't been getting a lot of meat lately, as you can imagine. Bread hasn't been so much. But we're still getting lots of fresh stuff, which is nice. We are a Gleaners Pantry pantry partner, and we're very lucky to have their leadership in the state. They have been feeling the pinch as well, and they've stopped doing the Wednesday blowouts and the cold room appointments where pantries can go in their truck and pick up food. But luckily, since we're a TFAP program and we receive allocations from the USDA, we've got lots of pantry staples. We've got canned potatoes. We've got the mixed vegetables. We've got pork with juices, which is actually a lot better than it sounds. As far as pantry staples go, we're doing very well. But there's lots of stuff that we also carry that has been dwindling a lot. We haven't seen any toilet paper since we got rid of our stock. Let's see, what else? Rice and pasta soups are down. Cereal is something that's, easy stuff that kids will eat and that's easy for parents to make. We're not seeing a whole bunch of. Mm. But other than that, I'm actually pretty optimistic that we can handle the load and keep it together, thanks in part to the grocery stores and definitely to Gleaners Food Bank and the other food banks. We went to Midwest Food Bank yesterday. They're great. We've gotten a lot of help from Million Meal Movement. Lots of folks are pulling together, and we're very lucky to have the partners and the neighbors and the organizations that we do.
So for those who don't know how it works, tell us, you hear Gleaners and you hear Midwest Food Bank a lot, and you may not hear, the Sharing Place Food Bank in the local area. How does a Gleaners or a Midwest Food Bank work, and how does it interact with a facility like yours?
That part I'm a little fuzzy on.
Okay.
I'm not privy to their meetings and stuff. I know that Gleaners buys food the same way that we've heard in the news that Gleaners is now having to compete with the grocery stores for supply. Midwest, I imagine, is doing A-okay. I know that they do. They get a lot of donations from things that have fallen off the back of the truck or things that have been rejected from a store. And so truckers just bring that stuff over to them.
And so what they do is then they divide that out amongst all the food shelters across the city?
Yeah, pretty much. We drive our truck up, and lately they've had volunteers from, the National Guard sitting out there loading trucks up. So it's been nice and easy for us lately. We just drive the truck up. We don't even have to get out anymore, and those guys load it up, and we go home.
So really, they're using the National Guard out at Gleaners?
Yeah.
Interesting.
At Midwest. I imagine they could be using it at Gleaners too.
Do you have any wraparound services? What are called wraparound services? So if somebody is in need of something else and they're not sure where to get help, what connections might someone have if they come in to get some food, but then they need X, Y, or Z? Do you have resources that could help folks?
Not quite, but having been in the social service community for so long, we do have lots of partners and friends and neighbors who we can send folks to get help. For example, LCFS is partnered with Community Behavioral Health to run the day-to-day operations at Lutherwood. And due to that, we've got a list of social workers, and we've got social workers, we're good friends with the United Way and many of the other United Way partner agencies around the city. So we don't quite have wraparound services, but we definitely know where and to whom we can send people to get them the help they need.
Excellent. So if anybody out there listening is in a position to help, how do they maybe, are you looking for food donations, cash donations? What kind of help, volunteer services? What are you looking for, and how can people get in touch with you?
Cash donations are always great. With our partnership through Gleaners, we can use their grocery program to buy food below retail cost, which is super helpful. I'm not entirely sure that I want to send people out to the stores to shop with us, as we do need to be mindful of the supply chain. Folks can get in touch with me best by sending an email to sharingplace@lutheranfamily.org. I should also say that volunteers are our greatest need right now. I need all the youngins that folks can send. We prefer to have our volunteers over the age of 14 and under 60. But if you're 65 and you can run a 5K, I'll take you. And if you've got a precocious 11-year-old who will take the work seriously, I will take that kid too.
Excellent. And I will put the contact info in the show notes at nowhearthisindy.com. You can find that in the description and get in touch with them. Phil, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Phil May, Sharing Place Coordinator of Phil May, Sharing Place Coordinator, part of the Foundation for Lutheran Child and Family Services. Today I'm talking with one of my favorite restaurants in town, and it is Mimi Blue Good Food. I am talking to David Cosine. Tell us a little bit about what is Mimi Blue Good Food, where are you located, and what do you do normally?
Well, thank you. Yeah, we have three locations. Our first location, which we're 4 years old, on Massachusetts Avenue. And our second location is up in Carmel on Old Meridian Street. And then our newest location is at the Keystone Fashion Mall. We are a kind of a full-service restaurant, but we specialize in meatballs. But we also have many other things. We have salmon. We have a hamburger. We have a tenderloin. We try to check all the boxes. We have some vegetarian products. We have gluten-free, something for everybody's palate, hopefully.
Yeah, I once took a vegetarian date there, and she was greatly satisfied. So yeah. you really do tick all the boxes. So when this all started to unfold 3 to 4 weeks ago, what were some of your main concerns? I mean, what was going through your mind? How did you start to prepare the business, and what are you doing differently through this?
Well, it came pretty fast and furious for us, as well as so many other people in the country. But as you know, we were forced to close our indoor dining. So we had always done carry out, and we've always done third-party deliveries. And so we refocused and kind of pivoted and started to focus on what we had left, and that was deliveries and pickup. We're trying to do as much of that as possible.
How can people access that if they want to order something and have it delivered?
Sure. Two ways. You can call one of our three restaurants directly, or you can get online and get on our delivery service, which we're signed up with both Uber Eats, DoorDash, and Grubhub. So any one of those three, or call our restaurant, and you'll be able to order through us.
You're doing orders, you're trying to make it through, but you're also giving back, which I find remarkable. Why is it important for your company to add on a charity component and serve the community when when your industry and your business is going through a tough time?
Oh yeah, that's a good question. I think it comes to my brother and my nephew organically. Our father, my brother, and my father owned a car wash, and as we were growing up, and he was a very hard worker. He was the kind of guy that never met a stranger, never turned a blind eye to someone that needed help or just needed a break in life. And Jerry, my brother, and I learned that at an early age. We've modeled that in our business life from the very beginning of time. We've had some hard times. In fact, obviously these are very hard times for our business, but we don't give up. And at the same time, we're always recognizing that there is someone out there that has a little more of a struggle going on. And if we can make a difference, that brings us satisfaction. Our mother, Mimi, the namesake of our restaurant, was pretty modest, but I know that she would be proud and probably would have expected us to help others make it through these tough days, and make their days probably a little bit, you know, better. So it was obvious and fairly clear early on that we probably should do something for the frontline professionals that are working during this crisis. And you know, we through our Mimi's Care program, we said, let's try to figure out how we gather other people that are like-minded that want to support the frontline workers and help sponsor us sending food to the various hospitals, and it could be nursing homes, it could be the police or fire stations, but we want to give back to those people that are really the heroes today that are fighting this fight every single day, 24 hours a day.
And I apologize if I've been calling it Mimi and it's Mimi. Please forgive me.
It is Mimi, but it's fine. Yeah, she was called Mimi.
Through the Mimi Cares program, tell us what have you seen as you've gone out and delivered these meals? Where have you delivered them to? And what are people saying as you go out and talk to them in the community?
Oh, the feedback has been tremendous. I mean, the frontline workers, you know, the nurses, the doctors, the EMTs, those guys are just so appreciative because they get to that hospital, which we primarily have been so far delivering to the hospitals all around the city, and into Noblesville and Hamilton County. But they're so appreciative of us thinking of them, number one, recognizing what they do, and giving them some nourishment as they fight the fight every day.
So how much have you raised so far?
So far, and we, you know, we've been at it for about 3 weeks. We've raised in excess of $10,000.
Wow. So if people want
to we have some commitments for more.
And
we're looking for more. We're gonna keep delivering, keep providing food as long as this thing lasts.
So if people want to sponsor a meal and send it to one of these locations, how can they do that?
They can do it either through an inquiry on our website or call one of our locations directly, and we'll get right back to the person or business that's interested and organize a delivery.
So final question that I usually ask everyone, this final question. If you've got an audience here and, you know, you're experiencing a lot through this time and seeing a lot, if there's one thing that you want people to know that you wish other people could see, what is that?
Well, let's see. That's a good question. I think how hard and how challenging it probably is for most everybody. Quite honestly, this virus has affected everyone, and no one's immune to the effects of this, and some greater than others. But there's a lot of people out there that you don't even think about, or businesses that you don't even think about, that it's having a devastating effect on it. So I think this is the time that we all should look in front of us, to the side of us, and behind us, and say, how can we help the people that we see? Because everybody probably needs a little bit of help to get through this. And if we don't do it now, I'm not sure when we're ever going to do it. But we need to reach out and help where we can in the middle of this crisis.
Couldn't have said it better myself. David Cosine of Mimi Blue Good Food, thank you so much for joining me.
It's our pleasure. And if we can ever be of assistance, let us know.
And you can visit their website at mimiblue.com. Please go support them in this time of need, and we appreciate them so much. You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. And you can find more great shows like this at WeAreLibertarians.com. Shows like We Are Libertarians with Chris Spangle, The Brian Nichols Show, The Boss Hog of Liberty, Now Hear This with Chris Spangle, Gingerarchy with Tricia Stewart Mann, and our training podcast, Upward, Libertarian Activism. All of these shows are supported by our patrons. If you'd like to become a Patreon member, visit WeAreLibertarians.com. Thank you so much for listening to this show.